enter the World Trade Organization through the servants' entrance is how one member of the International Chamber of Commerce, an influential group at the WTO, describes the special relationship between his organization and, one can infer, industry groups in general, and the WTO. Over its relatively short life, the WTO has become a significant fetter on nations' abilities to protect their citizens from corporate misdeeds. More generally, economic globalization, of which the WTO is just one element, has substantially enhanced corporations' abilities to evade the authority of governments. Corporations have become sufficiently powerful to pose a threat to governments, says William Niskanen, chairman of the Cato Institute, and that is particularly the case with respect to multinational corporations, who will have much less dependence upon the positions of particular governments, much less loyalty in that sense. As Ira Jackson, former director of the Center for Business and Government at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, observes, corporations and their leaders have displaced politics and politicians as the new high priests and reigning oligarchs of our system. And, according to Samir Gibara, former CEO of Goodyear Tire, governments have become powerless in relation to corporations compared to what they were before. Corporations now govern society, perhaps more than governments themselves do. Yet, ironically, it is their very power, much of which they have gained through economic globalization, that makes them vulnerable. As is true of any ruling institution, the corporation now attracts mistrust, fear, and demands for accountability from an increasingly anxious public. Today's corporate leaders understand, as did their predecessors, that work is needed to regain and maintain the public's trust, and they, like their predecessors, are seeking to soften the corporation's image by presenting it as human, benevolent, and socially responsible. It's absolutely fundamental that a corporation today has as much of a human and personal characteristic as anything else, says public relations czar Chris Komisarjevsky, CEO of Burson Marsteller. The smart corporations understand that people make comparisons in human terms because that's the way people think. We think in terms that often are very, very personal. If you walk down the street with a microphone and a camera and you stopped people on the street, they will describe corporations in very human terms. Today, corporations use branding to create unique and attractive personalities for themselves. Branding goes beyond strategies designed merely to associate corporations with actual human beings, such as AT&T's early campaigns that featured workers and shareholders, or the more recent use of celebrity endorsements, such as Nike's Michael Jordan advertisements, and corporate mascots such as Ronald McDonald, Tony the Tiger, the Michelin Man, and Mickey Mouse. Corporations' brand identities are personifications of who they are and where they've come from, says Clay Timon, chairman of Landor Associates, the world's largest and oldest branding firm. Family magic for Disney, invent for Hewlett-Packard, Sunshine Foods for Dole are a few examples of what Timon calls brand drivers. Corporations as brands have souls, says Timon, which is what enables them to create intellectual and emotional bonds with the groups they depend upon, such as consumers, employees, shareholders, and regulators. Timon points to Lander's brand drivers for British Petroleum: progressive, performance, green, innovative, as evidence of how corporate environmental and social responsibility are emerging today as key branding themes. However, he says, Even companies that do not explicitly brand themselves as such must now embrace corporate social responsibility. Out of necessity, says Thiemann, companies, whether they want it or not, have had to take on a social responsibility. And that is partly a result of their new status as dominant institutions. They must now show that they deserve to be free of governmental constraints and indeed to participate in governing society. Corporations need to become more trustworthy, says Sam Gabara, a successor to social responsibility pioneer P.W. Litchfield. There has been a transfer of authority from the government to the corporation, and the corporation needs to assume that responsibility and needs to really behave as a corporate citizen of the world, needs to respect the communities in which it operates, and needs to assume the self-discipline that in the past governments required from it. Beginning in the mid-1990s, mass demonstrations against corporate power and abuse rocked North American and European cities. The protesters, part of a broader civil society movement, which also included non-governmental organizations, community coalitions, and labor unions, targeted corporate harms to workers, consumers, communities, and the environment. Their concerns were different from those of post-Enron worriers, for whom shareholders' vulnerability to corrupt managers was paramount. But the two groups had something in common. They both believed the corporation had become a dangerous mix of power and unaccountability. Corporate social responsibility is offered today as an answer to such concerns. Now more than just a marketing strategy, though it is certainly that, it presents corporations as responsible and accountable to society and thus purports to lend legitimacy to their new role as society's rulers. Chapter 2. Business as Usual. Business leaders today say their companies care about more than profit and loss, that they feel responsible to society as a whole, not just to their shareholders. Corporate social responsibility is their new creed, a self-conscious corrective to earlier greed-inspired visions of the corporation. Despite this shift, the corporation itself has not changed. It remains as it was at the time of its origins as a modern business institution in the middle of the 19th century, a legally designated person designed to valorize self-interest and invalidate moral concern. Most people would find its personality abhorrent, even psychopathic in a human being. Yet curiously, we accept it in society's most powerful institution. The troubles on Wall Street today, beginning with Enron's spectacular crash, can be blamed in part on the corporation's flawed institutional character. But the company was not unique for having that character. Indeed, all publicly traded corporations have it, even the most respected and socially responsible among them, such as Pfizer, Inc. In 1849, Charles Pfizer and his cousin, Charles Ehrhardt, established a small chemical firm in Williamsburg, then a rural section of Brooklyn, accessible from Manhattan only by boat. Over the last century and a half, the firm, Pfizer, Inc., has prospered and become the world's largest pharmaceutical company. Williamsburg, now linked to Manhattan by bridges and tunnels, also prospered, then declined, and now, at least in part because of Pfizer, it has enjoyed something of a revival. On a recent summer afternoon, Tom Klein, a senior vice president at Pfizer, took a documentary film crew on a walkabout tour of the inner-city neighborhood that now surrounds his company's original plant in Williamsburg. A tall white man in late middle age, dressed in neat blue slacks and a matching wrinkle-free short-sleeved shirt, Klein looked conspicuous in this predominantly low-income neighborhood, but he clearly felt at home here. During the tour, he greeted strangers on the street as if they were old friends, promising one woman that, "working with you and Pfizer and our other partnerships we'll make this a better place, and saying, love you, to another person after a brief conversation. The tour commenced at the Flushing Avenue subway station, whose stairwell entrance lies just across the street from the entrance to Pfizer's plant. Klein explained how he had almost been mugged on the subway station's platform one evening in the early 1980s as he waited for a train to take him home from the plant, where he then worked as plant manager. He had fled from the would-be muggers, made it safely to the far side of the tracks, and hid there terrified but oddly inspired by his plight to do something about the spiral of crime and drugs that was ruining the neighborhood. He had decided, at that perilous moment, to scuttle Pfizer's recently devised plan to close the plant and instead work to make a change to make this community better. Today, the plant is still open, and thanks to Klein and Pfizer, the subway station is safer. Klein showed the film crew a yellow box attached to the wall of a designated waiting area on the subway platform. The box is connected to a sophisticated security system, financed and maintained by Pfizer, which allows threatened subway patrons to summon help from Pfizer security guards at the nearby plant. Down the block from the station, at Pfizer's original corporate headquarters, there is a children's school, developed by Klein and partly funded by the company. Though the school is officially part of the New York City public school system, Principal Sonia Girardo explained that the children really have an ongoing relationship with the company through Pfizer mentors and volunteers. There is also a middle-income housing development in the neighborhood, spearheaded by the company's redevelopment program and administered jointly with the city. Klein believes that if we really want to improve the conditions of American cities, we business people have to take responsibility. And his actions show that these are not empty words. As Hank McKinnell, chairman and CEO of Pfizer, said, Klein is the driving force behind the rejuvenation of a very devastated inner city area. McKinnell, however, wants Pfizer to do more than just save cities. Pfizer can be the company which does more good for more people than any other company on the planet, he said. Every year, his company donates hundreds of millions of dollars worth of products and cash around the globe, making it claims, one of America's most generous companies. McKinnell is especially proud of the company's work to end trachoma, an infection that blinds 8 to 10 million people every year. Pfizer produces Zithromax, a drug that prevents trachoma with just a single dose per year, and donates it to African countries. McKinnell claims that the drug has cut the infection rate in Africa in half and could eliminate the disease altogether by the year 2020. We at Pfizer never stop looking for innovative solutions to society's problems, the company proclaims on its website. Whether it's donating medicine to people in need, or lending employees to local schools, or rebuilding our first neighborhood, we are dedicated to our company purpose, helping people around the world live healthier, more productive lives. Corporations have always been philanthropic. They have donated to charities, sponsored little league teams, and helped to build theaters. Traditionally, such generosity was quietly practiced and peripheral to their main goal of making money. Now, however, large corporations such as Pfizer have put corporate good deeds at the core of their business plans. A sense of responsibility to society, not just to a company's shareholders, has come to define the very nature of the corporation, what it is supposed to be, and what it must and cannot do. Corporations are now often expected to deliver the good, not just the goods, to pursue values, not just value, and to help make the world a better place. During the 1980s, testosterone-fueled corporate slashers such as Sunbeam's Chainsaw Al Dunlap, who once posed on a magazine cover wielding a machine gun to symbolize his take-no-prisoners approach to management, were cheered as heroes and fearless knights of the bottom line. These men now seem like barbarians, uncouth and uncool, as ridiculous as their red suspenders. Today's leading CEOs cultivate compassion and seem genuinely concerned about how their corporation's actions affect social and environmental interests, not just their stockholders. They say they are obliged to meet social and environmental bottom lines, not just the financial one. As Goodyear Tire's Samir Gabara explained, today, the corporation is much broader than just its shareholders. The corporation has many more constituencies and needs to address all these needs. Its obligations are no longer limited to making money for investors, but, according to William Ford Jr., chairman of the Ford Motor Company and great-grandson of corporate social responsibility pioneer Henry Ford, corporations could be and should be a major force for resolving environmental and social concerns in the 21st century. Former Harvard Business Scholar Ira Jackson believes that such attitudes herald the start of an entirely new stage of capitalism, what he calls capitalism with a conscience. There is much evidence to support his view. Corporations now boast about social and environmental initiatives on their websites and in their annual reports. Entire departments and executive positions are devoted to these initiatives. The business press runs numerous features on social responsibility and ranks corporations on how good they are at it. Business schools launch new courses on social responsibility, and universities create centers devoted to its study. At the University of Nottingham, tobacco giant ABT donated $7 million to create an international center for corporate social responsibility. Social responsibility is on the agenda wherever business leaders meet. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, WTO ministerial meetings, industry conferences, and international trade and investment summits. And corporations compete against one another for ever higher moral ground. Pious social responsibility themes now vie with sex for top billing in corporate advertising, whether on television or in the pages of glossy magazines and newspapers. A recent television advertisement by Shell is typical. It shows self-styled romantic environmentalist Francis Abbotts Guardiola flying around beautiful mountains and lakes in a helicopter and talking to Aboriginal people in grass-roofed huts. She eyes skeptically a convoy of heavy dump trucks lumbering across the pristine landscape. This woman is trying to protect a fragile environment from being destroyed by oil and gas, a lyrical Scottish-accented narrator tells us. She must be one of those anti-corporate Greenpeace types, we think. Despite that, she's not at war with the oil company. She is the oil company, a Shell geologist, we learn. The message is clear, as is that of legions of similar advertisements. Corporations care about the environment and communities, not just the soulless pursuit of profit. They are part of the solution to world ills, not the cause. They are allies of governments and non-governmental organizations, not enemies. Just a few years ago, says Jackson, you'd have been laughed out of the office, if not escorted out by an armed guard, for suggesting to a CEO that his corporation should abide by the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Yet recently in New York, 100 CEOs from the world's largest corporations met with their counterparts from NGOs such as Greenpeace and Amnesty International, along with national ambassadors, to sign a promise to adhere to the general principles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This is just one example, says Jackson, of the new corporate order of conscience. He, along with many other business pundits, applauds big business leaders who embrace the values of corporate social responsibility and predicts failure for those who do not. Even President Bush now says that corporate responsibility is a fundamental business value, indeed, a patriotic duty. America is ushering in a responsibility era, a culture regaining a sense of personal responsibility, he told a group of top business leaders in a speech addressing Enron's collapse. And this new culture must include a renewed sense of corporate responsibility. Business relationships, like all human relationships, are built on a foundation of integrity and trust. Not everyone, however, is convinced of corporate social responsibility's virtue. Milton Friedman, for one, a Nobel laureate and one of the world's most eminent economists, believes the new moralism in business is, in fact, immoral. When Friedman granted me an interview, his secretary warned that he would get up and walk out of the room if he found my questions dull. So I was apprehensive as I waited for him in the lobby of his building. This must be how Dorothy felt, I thought, just before Toto pulled back the curtain to reveal the real Wizard of Oz. Friedman is an intellectual giant, revered and feared, deified and vilified, larger than life. So I felt some relief when he entered the room smiling, a charming little man who, like the wizard himself, barely broke 5 feet. Friedman surveyed the lobby, now a chaotic makeshift television studio. The interview was for a government-funded TV documentary. Lights and cameras cluttered the room. Tangles of wire covered the floor. 2 crew members stood ready, cotton balls in hand, to remove the shine on the great man's nose. Bemused, Friedman curmudgeonized. ABC came in here the other day with 2 guys and 1 camera. Here we see government fat and waste at its worst. Friedman thinks that corporations are good for society, and that too much government is bad. He recoils, however, at the idea that corporations should try to do good for society. A corporation is the property of its stockholders, he told me. Its interests are the interests of its stockholders. Now, beyond that, should it spend the stockholders' money for purposes which it regards as socially responsible, but which it cannot connect to its bottom line? The answer, I would say, is no. There is but one social responsibility for corporate executives, Friedman believes. They must make as much money as possible for their shareholders. This is a moral imperative. Executives who choose social and environmental goals over profits, who try to act morally, are in fact immoral. There is, however, one instance when corporate social responsibility can be tolerated, according to Friedman, when it is insincere. The executive who treats social and environmental values as means to maximize shareholders' wealth, not as ends in themselves, commits no wrong. It's like putting a good-looking girl in front of an automobile to sell an automobile, he told me. That's not in order to promote pulchritude. That's in order to sell cars. Good intentions, like good-looking girls, can sell goods. It's true, Friedman acknowledges, that this purely strategic view of social responsibility reduces lofty ideals to hypocritical window dressing. But hypocrisy is virtuous when it serves the bottom line. Moral virtue is immoral when it does not. Though Friedman's views are rejected by many sophisticated business people who think his brand of cynicism is old-fashioned, mean-spirited, and out of touch with reality, his suspicion of corporate social responsibility attracts some weighty support. William Niskanen, a former Ford economist and now chairman of the Cato Institute, said he would not invest in a firm that pioneered in corporate social responsibility. I think Ford Motor Company still makes fine cars and trucks, he continued, but I think the socially responsible actions by the new Mr. Ford are likely to undermine the value of the corporation to the owners. Peter Drucker, the guru of all business gurus, who believes that Friedman is probably our greatest living economist, echoes his view that corporate social responsibility is a dangerous distortion of business principles. If you find an executive who wants to take on social responsibility, Drucker said, fire him, fast. Harvard Business School professor Deborah Spar insisted that corporations are not institutions that are set up to be moral entities. They are institutions which have really only one mission, and that is to increase shareholder value. And Noam Chomsky, Friedman's intellectual and ideological nemesis, shares his view that corporations must be concerned only for their stockholders and not the community or the workforce or whatever. Corporations are created by law and imbued with purpose by law. Law dictates what their directors and managers can do, what they cannot do, and what they must do. And, at least in the United States and other industrialized countries, the corporation, as created by law, most closely resembles Milton Friedman's ideal model of the institution. It compels executives to prioritize the interests of their companies and shareholders above all others and forbids them from being socially responsible, at least genuinely so. In 1916, Henry Ford learned this legal lesson the hard way and unwittingly helped entrench the law's intolerance of corporate social responsibility. Ford believed that his Ford Motor Company could be more than just a profit machine. He paid his workers substantially more than the going rate at the time and rewarded customers with yearly price cuts on his Model T cars. Their original price of more than $900 was slashed to $440 by 1916. "I do not believe that we should make such awful profits on our cars," he is reported to have said. "A reasonable profit is right, but not too much." John and Horace Dodge had helped Ford establish his company in 1906 with a $10,500 investment. They were major shareholders, and John Dodge became a director of the company. The brothers had also pledged that their Chicago machine shop would make parts exclusively for Ford, having turned down overtures from the more established Oldsmobile Company. By 1916, however, the Dodge brothers had larger ambitions. John Dodge quit the Ford board and devised a plan with his brother to build their own car company. They hoped to finance the venture with the quarterly dividends from their Ford shares, but were stopped by Ford's decision to cancel the dividend and divert the money to customers in the form of further price reductions on Model T automobiles. The Dodge brothers took Ford to court. Profits belong to shareholders, they argued, and Ford had no right to give their money away to customers, however good his intentions. The judge agreed. He reinstated the dividend and rebuked Ford, who had said in open court that business is a service, not a bonanza, and that corporations should be run only incidentally to make money, for forgetting that a business corporation is organized and carried on primarily for the profit of the stockholders. It could not be run for the merely incidental benefit of shareholders and for the primary purpose of benefiting others. Dodge versus Ford still stands for the legal principle that managers and directors have a legal duty to put shareholders' interests above all others and no legal authority to serve any other interests, what has come to be known as the best interests of the corporation principle. That principle provided a legal fix to a flaw in the corporate form that had famously worried Adam Smith 140 years before Dodge versus Ford was decided. Smith, in his 1776 classic, The Wealth of Nations, said he was troubled by the fact that corporations' owners, their shareholders, did not run their own businesses, but delegated that task to professional managers. The latter could not be trusted to apply the same anxious vigilance to manage other people's money as they would their own, he wrote, and negligence and profusion therefore must prevail, more or less, in the management of such a company. The best interests of the corporation principle, now a fixture in the corporate laws of most countries, addresses Smith's concern by compelling corporate decision makers always to act in the best interests of the corporation and hence its owners. The law forbids any other motivation for their actions, whether to assist workers, improve the environment, or help consumers save money. They can do these things with their own money as private citizens. As corporate officials, however, stewards of other people's money, they have no legal authority to pursue such goals as ends in themselves, only as means to serve the corporation's own interests, which generally means to maximize the wealth of its shareholders. Corporate social responsibility is thus illegal, at least when it is genuine. Corporate lawyer Robert Hinckley quit his job at international legal powerhouse Skadden Arps when he realized after 23 years in practice that the law in its current form actually inhibits executives and corporations from being socially responsible. As he puts it, the corporate design contained in hundreds of corporate laws throughout the world is nearly identical. The people who run corporations have a legal duty to shareholders, and that duty is to make money. Failing this duty can leave directors and officers open to being sued by shareholders. The law dedicates the corporation to the pursuit of its own self-interests and equates corporate self-interest with shareholder self-interest. No mention is made of responsibility to the public interest. Corporate law thus casts ethical and social concerns as irrelevant or as stumbling blocks to the corporation's fundamental mandate. Does this mean that the big corporations that now embrace social responsibility, Pfizer, Ford, Goodyear, BP, to name just a few, are outlaws? Not exactly. Recall Milton Friedman's belief that social responsibility can be tolerated when in the service of corporate self-interest. On this point, the law again agrees with him. Hutton versus West Cork Railway Company, a case from 19th century England, established the relevant principle. One company, Bandon, had bought another, West Cork Railway. When West Cork announced a bonus of several thousand pounds to its soon-to-be-redundant directors, Bandon's shareholders took the railway to court. The money from which the bonus would be drawn now belonged to them, they argued, and it could not be used to benefit others, i.e., the West Cork directors. Lord Bowen, one of the judges who heard the case, agreed with their claim, but he also insisted that corporate generosity was, in some cases, permissible under the law. Take this sort of instance, he wrote. A railway company, or the directors of the company, might send down all the porters at a railway station to have tea in the country at the expense of the company. Why should they not? After all, Lord Bowen observed, the company might itself derive considerable benefit from such generosity in light of the fact that a company which always treated its employees with draconian severity and never allowed them a single inch more than the strict letter of the bond would soon find itself deserted. Hence, Lord Bowen concluded, the law does not say that there are to be no cakes and ale, but there are to be no cakes and ale except such as are required for the benefit of the company. Charity has no business to sit at boards of directors qua charity. There is, however, a kind of charitable dealing which is for the interest of those who practice it, and to that extent and in that garb, I admit not a very philanthropic garb, charity may sit at the board, but for no other purpose. Today, the law remains the same. Charitable dealing must be in the interest of those who practice it, the corporation and its shareholders. While allowing directors to give consideration to the interests of others, states the American Bar Association, the law compels them to find some reasonable relationship to the long-term interests of shareholders when so doing. The rule is now thoroughly entrenched within the corporation's culture, so it is a rare case when shareholders must resort to the courts to enforce it, as the Dodge brothers had to do in 1916. As Burson Marsteller head Chris Komisarjevsky put it, the expectations of investors whether they're institutional or individual, will always make sure that the driving force is to make sure that we produce the profits, we produce the returns, and therefore give back to the investors. So there's rarely going to be a situation where philanthropy or corporate giving will undermine the corporate performance from a financial perspective. The rule that corporations exist solely to maximize returns to their shareholders is the law of the land, to quote business journalist Marjorie Kelly, universally accepted as a kind of divine, unchallengeable truth. And today, even the most inspired leaders of the corporate social responsibility movement obey it. On April 22, 1999, Earth Day, at the UN building in New York City, Sir John Brown, head of BP, the world's second largest oil company and the largest single supplier of oil and gas in the United States, received an award. After just 4 years at the helm, Brown had restored the once great company to its former glory. The Queen of England had knighted him for his efforts, business chiefs had lionized him, and Wall Street had responded to his success with record prices for BP shares. But Brown was not being honored for this spectacular corporate turnaround. Surprisingly, Brown, leader of an industry vilified by environmentalists, was at the United Nations to collect an award for environmental leadership. Astonishing leadership, according to Dennis Hayes, whose coalition of environmental groups, Earth Day Network, had joined with the United Nations to bestow this honor. In 1998, Brown acknowledged that greenhouse gas emissions might cause global warming, a heretical admission for an oil industry executive. He then endorsed the Kyoto Protocol on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, pulled out of the oil-led Global Climate Coalition, which had spent tens of millions of dollars lobbying against the protocol, and promised that his own company would exceed, not just meet, the Kyoto targets. By 1999, Brown had left the church of the oil industry, as he puts it, paraphrasing a fellow oilman's accusation, to become the world's first green oil titan. Brown, who is slight in stature and always impeccably groomed, is no macho oilman. He regularly attends the opera and ballet, collects pre-Columbian art, and is a top Cambridge University physics graduate. He speaks with a quiet but authoritative voice and delivers eloquent and inspirational speeches, like the one he gave at the United Nations upon receiving his award. "We meet at an historic moment, on the edge of a new century," he began his speech. "There is a sense of trepidation about the new century, and of course, many of the fears are raised by the unresolved challenges to the natural environment. I know there is a view that business is simply the cause of many of the environmental problems, but I hope we're moving beyond that argument. We have to help people transcend the harsh trade-off, which says you can have economic growth and pollution, or you can have a clean environment, but no growth. That's an unacceptable trade-off." When he made this speech in 1999, many industry insiders still considered Brown an eccentric, a maverick. Just a year later, he was Mr. Oil and Gas in the world today, according to Calgary oilman Jim Gray, who chaired the World Petroleum Conference 2000. And invited Brown to be its keynote speaker. In that short time, Brown's green agenda had become the industry's agenda, embraced by Shell Oil and other big players. "Ethical issues are starting to become big issues in terms of social responsibility," Jim Gray explained. "Sir John Brown has said, if you're not with it in these areas, you're a dinosaur. You're living yesterday. Well, we're living tomorrow." "Can business be about more than profits?" asks a Brown-inspired BP ad. We think so. Sir John Brown's deep convictions, along with the company's green brand image, imply a promise that the company's environmental values are more than just talk. They are at least on a par with profits, positioned alongside them on a multiple bottom, a favorite metaphor of Brown's, rather than subordinate to the single bottom line of financial performance. Brown's vision implies that corporations and those who run them can genuinely care about values other than profit. Yet that is exactly what the law forbids, at least when such caring might diminish profitability. The real question, then, is whether a business can be about less than profits. Can BP be not just Beyond Petroleum, the clever wordplay used in its ad campaigns, but also beyond profit? Can it sacrifice its own interests and those of its shareholders to realize environmental and social goals? Not surprisingly, Milton Friedman said no when I asked him how far John Brown could go with his green convictions. You take that case insofar as he wants to pursue those environmental interests, he said. He can do it with his own money. If he pursues those environmental interests in such a way as to run the corporation less effectively for its stockholders, then I think he's being immoral. He's an employee of the stockholders, however elevated his position may appear to be. As such, he has a very strong moral responsibility to them. Norma Cassie hopes Friedman is wrong. She wants Brown to do the right thing for the environment, even if that is not the best thing for his company. And for her, the question of what Brown should or might do is more than academic. It is a matter of survival. Norma Cassie recently traveled to London, England, from Old Crow, a remote Yukon village 60 miles north of the Arctic Circle, to attend BP's annual general meeting. She went there for one purpose: to try to stop the company from coming to the Arctic to destroy us. Cassie is a member of the Gwich'in Nation, an Arctic Aboriginal people whose 17 villages built thousands of years ago straddled the U.S.-Canadian border. She believes that drilling on the Arctic slope's coastal plain will wipe out the porcupine caribou herd and, along with it, her people's 20,000-year-old way of life. Huge oil and natural gas reserves may sit just below the coastal plain, and huge profits could await the companies granted the right to explore and drill there. BP is a likely candidate for that privilege if the U.S. government ends its moratorium on drilling in the area. The company is already the major player in the region, with a large presence at nearby Prudhoe Bay, one of the world's biggest oil drilling sites. Astronauts report being able to see it from space at night when it is lit up. The coastal plain also provides calving grounds for the porcupine caribou herd. Each spring, the herd treks 400 miles across mountains, rivers, and tundra, past Gwich'in villages strategically located along the caribou's trail, so that the pregnant cows can give birth to their young on the coastal plain. The Gwich'in rely on the porcupine herd for their survival, as they have for thousands of years. And it's not just food and clothing, but also their cultural and spiritual lives that depend upon the herd's yearly migration. Cassie recalls how her family would pack up its dog sled each spring and head to the tundra to wait for the caribou. They would live in a tent atop the packed ice, with a spruce bough floor and a wood-burning stove to keep them warm, and her mother would keep watch for the caribou from a hole in the tent door. Sometimes she'd go outside and she'd ask the ravens, "Where are the caribou?" recalls Cassie. I'd watch her and I'd watch her face, and I'd know when the caribou were coming close. Cassie's grandfather and the other hunters would travel to the back of the herd to hunt the older bulls, leaving alone the pregnant cows at the front. When the hunters returned to camp, Sometimes 3 or 4 days later, the Gwich'in would feast, and they would watch reverentially as the caribou passed by on their way to the coastal plain. "It's a very sacred time. It's a quiet time," says Cassie. "You have to give thanks to the caribou, and we give special thanks to the cows. We pray for them, especially the women. We can connect with them. We can feel what they feel as women and as mothers." The Gwich'in say that drilling on the coastal plain will destroy the porcupine herd and their way of life along with it. BP has played down their concerns. "Exploration and production done to the highest standards has minimal environmental impact and takes place in harmony with healthy wildlife populations," says John Gore, one of the company's top officials. "And contrary to the caribou being harmed by development, they could thrive on it," according to the company's website. The number of caribou in the Central Arctic herd spending a portion of the year in the Prudhoe Bay area has increased more than sixfold since development began in the mid-70s. Many scientists, however, agree with the Gwich'in that coastal plain development would very likely result in drastic and irreversible consequences for the Gwich'in and the porcupine caribou. The caribou would be forced into the adjacent mountains, they say, where newborn calves would be killed by predators and starvation. The herd would thus be greatly diminished, a conclusion scientists have reached despite the more positive fate of the Central Arctic herd, which they say is irrelevant to assessing drilling's impact on the porcupine herd. The caribou would be forced into the adjacent mountains, they say, where newborn calves would be killed by predators and starvation. The herd would thus be greatly diminished, a conclusion scientists have reached despite the more positive fate of the Central Arctic herd, which they say is irrelevant to assessing drilling's impact on the porcupine herd. So, hundreds of scientists have joined environmentalists, some U.S. politicians, the Canadian government, and the Gwich'in to call for application of the precautionary principle, an international legal principle that enjoins activities that could irreversibly harm people or the environment, even if there is no definitive proof the harm will occur, to forbid exploration and drilling on the coastal plain. Sir John Brown is one of the leading advocates of the precautionary principle in the world today. When other oil industry leaders rejected the Kyoto Protocol, citing absence of proof that greenhouse gas emissions cause global warming, Brown invoked the precautionary principle to defend it. "Despite the lack of proof," he said, "it would be dangerous to ignore the mounting evidence and concern over global warming and greenhouse gases. There is a need to take precautionary action now," which is what he did by endorsing the protocol and committing his company to respect its standards. Yet Brown seems unwilling to take precautionary action on the coastal plain. He has rejected calls to refrain from drilling, despite the strong scientific evidence that disaster could strike the Gwich'in and the caribou if drilling proceeds. John Brown may be a maverick. He may even be one of the most outspoken advocates of social responsibility in big business today. But he's neither a radical nor an outlaw. He well understands the corporate canon that social and environmental values are not ends in themselves, but strategic resources to enhance business performance. This is not a sudden discovery of moral virtue or a sense of guilt about past errors, he says of his green agenda. It is about long-term self-interest, enlightened, I hope, but self-interest nonetheless. BP's social responsibility, he says, is good business, driven by practical commercial reality and hard-headed business logic. The company's good deeds are in our direct business interest, not acts of charity, but of what could be called enlightened self-interest, coldly realistic. The fundamental test for any company, says Brown, is performance. That is the imperative. By implication, social responsibility is not appropriate when it could undermine a company's performance. That is why BP must drill on the coastal plain if that is the most beneficial, i.e. profitable, long-term course for the company when all factors are considered. Concerns about destroying a caribou herd, the Arctic environment, or an entire Aboriginal people have no place, at least not as ends in themselves, in the corporation's decision-making lexicon. The costs to the company of not drilling could be huge. The benefits, customer goodwill or positive publicity, would likely be relatively small by comparison. So, if the coastal plain is opened to drilling, BP will surely be there as long as drilling is profitable. Brown really has no choice in the matter. Regardless of how deep and sincere his personal commitment to the environment is, as a CEO, Brown must put his company and its shareholders' interests above all others. Unlike a refusal to drill on the coastal plain, BP's green initiatives to date have been relatively inexpensive, designed to enhance performance and yield short and long-term benefits that outweigh their costs. BP met its commitment to implement the Kyoto Protocol standards, for example, at no net cost to itself. Other BP programs, such as solar-powered gas stations, school programs, and urban clean air initiatives, have similarly helped the company bolster its green image at little cost. The benefits to BP of these initiatives are obvious. As Brown says, they create a corporate image that serves as a source of competitive advantage over other companies, giving consumers of oil and gas a greener alternative. Performance is enhanced, he says, when a company is aligned with the interests and wishes of its consumers. The reputation of a company in the widest sense has a direct impact on its commercial fortunes. There is, however, another longer-term benefit that BP seeks to gain from its green image. Plenty of oil and gas remains in the ground, and Brown knows that there is still much money to be made by getting it out. Yet consumers could be driven away from oil and gas by environmental concerns and toward alternative forms of energy. Brown says that he believes it is possible to explore for, produce, refine, distribute, and use hydrocarbons in ways which don't damage the environment, that you can have a powerful car, which is great to drive, and still not damage the environment. He wants consumers to believe that, too. Despite the company's claim to be beyond petroleum and its involvement with solar energy and other alternatives, the primary goal behind Brown's green agenda, it would appear, is to maintain consumer demand for petrochemicals. The days when our business had a captive market for oil are probably ending. There are new sources of supply in almost every part of the energy market. Even in transportation, it is likely that advances in the technology of fuel cells will soon give us cars with different engines. So we have to compete to ensure that oil remains a fuel of choice. More generally, for Brown and all other big business leaders, social and environmental goals are and must be strategies to advance the interests of their companies and shareholders. They can never legitimately be pursued as ends in themselves. That may seem an unduly narrow view, especially when one considers the concrete social and environmental benefits corporate initiatives could foster. But no one among leaders of publicly traded companies is prepared or legally authorized to take corporate social responsibility any further. Hank McKinnell, the CEO of Pfizer, who says he wants his company to do more good for more people than any other company in the world, concedes that corporate self-interest is and must be the primary motivation behind his company's good deeds. There's a very direct benefit to Pfizer, McKinnell says of the company's security system at the Flushing Avenue subway station. In order to attract the best colleagues, we need to be a safe place to work, a good place to work. People need to be able to use the subways in order to get to work. So if we have a subway station that people are fearful of passing through, clearly that's a disincentive to be able to hire the best employees. The Pfizer-sponsored school in the neighborhood and a host of other education projects Pfizer has initiated and supported are also linked to the success of our own enterprise, McKinnell says. Unless we have a large pool of candidates who are trained in our business and the sciences and mathematics, we won't succeed in our business. McKinnell similarly justifies Pfizer's free drug programs as beneficial to the company. He emphasized that they cost the company little. The marginal cost of our drugs is very low. So if we give away a drug to somebody who wouldn't otherwise buy it, the profit impact of that action on us is just about zero. Yet the benefits to Pfizer are substantial. The programs generate goodwill among doctors, the primary dispensers of Pfizer products. They help them realize that we're there working with them to help solve their problems. They also help Pfizer with its employees, as morale, productivity, and the attraction and retention of good workers all depend upon employees feeling good about their company. McKinnell says, it's important to the people